four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
Okay, you can
smile, A, B, C. Hana? Just say something. Nice little alphabets. And that way we'll get a recording.
Oh, I see. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q.
Sounds like a teacher, isn't it?
Q, R, S, and T, V, W, X, and Y, and Z.
Okay.
Okay, well, that's good. Okay, are we going now?
Yes.
Okay. Today is Sunday, December 2nd, 1990. We're interviewing Hana Yasutakangas in Palmer. And with me are Kazumi Hishigi and Kyo Hoshiko. We're here on a very blustery, cold day in Palmer. But I think it's going to be a very warm interview, isn't it, Hana?
I hope so. It all depends on what you're going to be asking.
This is the first interview that we're having with Hana as part of the Alaska Japanese Pioneers Research Project. And our intent is that this become a public record. So we ask that you provide the information, and if there's anything that you think may be controversial or that you don't want people to know about, just indicate before you say it that you prefer not to discuss that. Can you first start by giving us your full name and your family name?
Hana and Yafrat Yasuda is my maiden name. I have changed it to Hana Yasutakangas for several reasons.
Can you give us a spelling so we have that correctly?
You mean Hana?
All of it.
H-A-N-A Y-A-S-U-D-A K-A-N-G-A-S.
And also your Eskimo name.
I'm very sorry about that Eskimo name. I have never, it had started with an E, but the alphabet now, and I have failed to learn how to spell it.
Uh-huh.
But it is in Yavdak, and E is I,
uh-huh.
So it starts with an I now. And I'm afraid I'm not pronouncing it right either.
Okay, maybe we can do some research and find a pronunciation in the spelling. So say it one more time so we've got a good, clear sound on it.
It's not for me to say it wrong. It's something like Ilyavrak.
Okay, thank you. Can you tell me a little bit about where you were born and where?
I was born in Beaver on the Yukon, November 24th, 1914.
And can you give us a little bit of background on your family there in Beaver?
Well, during those years, I'd already had a sister, Bernice, and my father, Frank Yasuda, had a store, a trading post, and he took care of the post office. And it was a small community of Inupiats from Barrow and a few Athabascans, especially the Kuching people.
Mm-hmm. And how did he happen to arrive there in Beaver?
Well, there was they were in Barrow when an engineer from Montana named Thomas Carter came through and needed a guide. And so Charlie Brower mentioned that Frank Yasuda was going to make a trip down to the Chandler area where the gold had been found. And that's how they started going down to the Chandler area.
And what time was that approximately?
It must be around, must have been around maybe 1903.
So it was right around the turn of the century then.
Mm-hmm.
And what about your mother? Tell me more about her.
My mother Luke was already married to my father in Barrow, and there had been an epidemic, and they lost their first child, and my father felt that he had to move my mother out of the area because she was not getting along very well. Evidently, she was in some kind of a shock. And so when this trip came about, he took her with him down to the Chandler area.
Mm-hmm. And what about your sister Bernice then? When was she born?
She was born, let me see. She was born in 1910 in Carroll, Alaska. That's on the Chandler River.
Uh-huh. So your parents were living there before going to Beaver?
They were not really living there. They went there for some reason, because there used to be an NC store there.
Oh.
And they would go there for provisions. And they were there for a while because my mother was going to have a baby. I think they were traveling between Chandler and Beaver back up and going to Carroll, because Carroll is en route to the Chandler.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were there special medical facilities there or something, or did they just by chance be there?
You mean the provisions?
No, the time when your sister was born.
No, they knew that Carroll had a store there, and so that was the reason they went there, I guess, for provisions, and she was born in Carroll, and I was born in Beaver 4 years later,
mm-hmm.
and by that time they had a place in Beaver.
Now, are there others in your family?
I had a younger sister that was 4 years younger, and she passed away when she was about 6.
And what was her name?
Her name was Florida.
Florida. Oh. So there were 3 then?
Besides the first one. Mm-hmm. There were 4 girls in the family.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what family life was like in Beaver?
Oh, it was really very pleasant, I think. We had no family laws that I can think of. You know, we never hear don't do this or don't do that. I can't remember anything like that. We had a lot of freedom. And a lot of things to do.
What kind of life occurred in your household when you had some Japanese backgrounds, some Inupiat background? Was it a nice mixture of all kinds of things, or how could you characterize that?
I can only remember my father's food, which I liked very much, but he never taught us any Japanese. I don't think there was enough time during those years when they were freighting and people were going in and out with their dog teams to really do much of anything but to, you know, talk about the day. But he never really talked to us about his background. I'm talking about the years that I spent there, because when I was 8 years old, I was already gone to school in Washington. So, you know, I missed a lot of that part that maybe we could have heard about my father's background. I knew more about the Athabascan background. I think by that time I had a very good friend my age, and we played around a lot. I was over to her home a lot, so I knew what they ate. It was Antoinette Henry, and her family was from Stevens Village, I think, and they moved up to Beaver.
Mm-hmm. So there was a noticeable difference between your household and Antoinette's household.
Not so. I think that the Newpiats took over a lot of necessary things like foods that, you know, like up in Bell, they ate whale and seal and white fish and birds, ducks.
Mm-hmm.
But in Beaver, they no longer had the whale and the seal or walrus. They had moose. They did have caribou, which is similar, I think, to reindeer. They had some ducks and some geese,
mm-hmm.
rabbits. But I noticed that my mother never accepted some of the foods that were eaten there, maybe because it was just too new, like porcupine and bear and squirrels. We never got a chance to eat any of that,
mm-hmm.
you know. And salmon was something else. It was, like, too strong for her to eat, so she was forever getting whitefish from friends. Because that's what they're used to up in the Arctic, the whitefish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Beryl doesn't have any salmon, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
What other kinds of things did you learn from your mother while you were growing up?
During that time, I don't think I learned much of anything. We just had a lot of fun playing, but after having my own family and directing my girls at times, there's a difference in the way we taught. My mother never seemed to have said no. I never knew this until I was already married with children, that she never said, when the answer is absent, that was no. But when it was okay, then she would talk about it. But if she did not talk about something, it meant no. And we were never scolded. I've never been spanked, so there's... That was the...
Was that characteristic, you think, of your friend Antoinette's house, too?
That I don't know. I don't remember them being spanked either.
Mm-hmm.
Life was really nice and, you know, no barriers, it seems like. You know, we got along so well with them, even though some people said that the Eskimos and the Indians fought. My mother's good friend there was Annie Colin. And Annie taught my mother how to make moccasins and how to tan
mm-hmm.
moose and how to bead. You know, these things were, the Eskimos didn't really know too much about that. They did a lot of skin work.
Mm-hmm. How would you spell Annie's last name?
I don't really know, because she was gone. After I came back, I was gone for 10 years, and I never really knew her.
Mm.
But I just know that my mother spoke very well about her.
How big was Beaver at that time when you were growing up?
I remember people coming and going, because they were coming down for provisions from Chandler and going back up. And we knew about these people up in the Chandler and Big Creek and Carroll. But when we would see them, we knew who they were, but we never knew how many really at the time. But when I came home, in 1934, there were about 100 people there, I think.
Mm. Uh-huh. And it was an amalgamation then of Inupiat and Kuchin folks?
Yes. Not only that, we had a lot of Caucasians.
And why were they there?
They were there for trapping and for mining. Yeah, we had quite a few of those. We had the Swede boys were good friends of ours.
Was that their names, or was that what they were?
Everybody referred to them as the Swede boys. Oh, the Swede boys are coming now. They're coming with their boats, you know, coming across the Yukon. And they would be coming in the spring, the first breakup, you know. And but later on in my years, I found that Dick Morris was Irish. Olaf Salvik was Norwegian. And Victor Olsen was a Swede. So the three were called the Swede boys. And how come that happened? I don't know.
Sounds like a generic term for that kind of people.
Yeah. And I remember Joe Roberts and Tony Rose. They were from the Portugal area, you know. I remember Joe Roberts being very fair. Didn't give it any thought in those years, but I remember him now as being very fair with blue eyes. And Tony Rose, coming from about the same area, I think, was very swarthy, he had black kind of kinky hair, but wonderful people.
Were there any other Japanese in Beaver?
There was George Oshima.
Mm-hmm.
They found him between, around Chandelier, I think. Way out in the back someplace, up towards the north. My father and mother and some families were traveling. I think they were coming down toward Beaver. And they saw something at a distance and didn't know what it was. And as they traveled on, they decided it was a dog team. And then somebody said he's having trouble. And so who went over there to help? My mother did. Well, everybody stayed with the dog teams. And when she came back, she said that she's, I don't know that man. And so we want to know what happened. Well, the sled had tipped over, and this man could not put the sled upright again and couldn't get going. So my father said, we could see Mom, we could see your mother just lift up that sled and put it back so easily. And we used to kind of laugh about that because we knew that my mother was so strong. The thing is, she never struck us or got after us, but for some reason we were always afraid of her. I guess I think we knew she was so strong. But that was George Oshima. And my mother would say, well, he couldn't do it because his fingers were so long and thin, and he was so quite fragile, you know. But and I don't know, I think he came from the southern part of Japan. It seems to me there's a place called Oshima something down there. And he came up as a cook, but after I grew older, whether he was a cook or not, I don't know, but he always subscribed to the New York Times. And he'd never read the paper, but he'd take the stock reports out and keep that, and he'd give us the paper to read. But we heard that he had money put into Borden's and many different things, you know. So it was quite an interesting life for him, I think, playing the game. But George had a house about a mile below Beaver, a log house, and he trapped around Beaver when he came to live in Beaver.
So it was essentially your parents rescuing him and then bringing him into Beaver that caused him to then settle there?
I don't know. But my father was certainly surprised that there was another Japanese in the country at that time. You know, he just couldn't believe it, but there was George. And
now, did they carry on a lot in Japanese? And
no. I don't remember ever hearing a Japanese language. But I have heard my father sing, and I used to think, what a queer way of singing, you know. But now I know that it was Japanese, you know, not right now, but as I grew older and heard some Japanese music, I knew he was singing Japanese. And we had some records, but we never played them. I heard them, not very many of them, maybe one or two, and it was so foreign to us that we didn't listen to them.
You had cylinders then with a regular recorder?
No, they were round. They were like 78s, I think you'd call them. Very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And did you have a little player?
Oh, sure. Uh-huh. Crank. Uh-huh.
Can you physically describe what your parents looked like? Were they big or small? Or?
No, my father and mother were about the same size. I think my father was maybe a couple inches taller. He was not. I just read where he was about 5'4", but in his records, it was 5'3" when he was taken during the wartime. So, knowing myself, we lose inches. And I think maybe he was taller than 5'3". Maybe he could have been 5'4", 5'5". Mm-hmm. But my mother was tiny. She hardly ever weighed 100.
And she was able to write that sled.
Oh, she was strong. And you know, if I think I've told you this before, Ron, that I think it's a wonderful way of bringing up children, too. In a sense that it's a lot of humor in it. My mother never said, don't you ever do that again. Don't you ever go over there. Never have we heard those words. But another Eskimo girl and I, Martha, and I were stealing carrots. And we would have, you know, mud around our mouth. I don't know how we ate it, but it was good stuff, as I remembered. But Charlie Schultz, who had the garden, must have told my mother and father, but they never said anything to us. But one day Martha and I were in there having a feast, and we heard this bear. Well, we got out of there fast and never went back. And it wasn't until I came back from going to school in Washington 10 years later, and I was home for the summer from the college in Fairbanks. My mother said, do you remember the time you and Martha were eating carrots in Charlie Schultz's garden? And I said, yeah, but there was a bear. And she said, did you see it? I said, yes. And we found out we didn't even see anything. It was my mother behind the bushes, making a noise like a bear. And, you know, that's one way of keeping anybody out of the garden. But isn't that a gentle way?
It certainly is. It certainly is.
Yeah.
And it's only after the fact that you recognize those, I guess.
Way after, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think your point about seeing it once you are in the situation of having to raise your family.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
in
true.
Retrospect, you appreciate how you were raised.
Mm-hmm.
Your father was involved in everything in Beaver. Can you describe what he did?
Well, I used to say to him, how come you get all this garden from Charlie when all you do is get a box of seeds for him? And he laughed. He said, we never get all of his garden. We just go and get lettuce because they liked lettuce, my father and mother, especially my mother liked lettuce. And when springtime comes around, you know, or summer, she could hardly get her hands on something green to eat, you know, and so that's about what they got from the garden. And Charlie would bring over maybe a head of cabbage sometimes or some carrots, whatever he wanted to bring over. But you know, nowadays the seeds are quite expensive, but in those years they were not that expensive. Well, maybe it's because the money was a little different too, you know, but getting a box of seeds from Burpees and a couple other places for Charlie was really great because Charlie could not read or write. Mm-hmm. So he was very pleased to get the seeds because being from Michigan, he knew how to farm, and he had a beautiful garden there, and he had several large gardens, and they sent up by boat to Fort Yukon Mission School and the mission building to help the Hudson Stucks with their boys and girls there.
Was he paid for that, or did they do it just to support the mission?
They just did it.
And would he sell a portion of his garden goods then to people who were up in the Chandelier? Or?
Not that I know of, no. But we could always go over and get whatever we wanted, you know. He would always say, you want some, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I farmed with him, too. We farmed, I don't know. After seeing the farms in the Midwest, you wonder what your farms are. But we had a potato patch and turnip patch about a half mile back of Beaver on a little hill, just a very small hill.
How did people react to that who weren't used to eating those kinds of produce?
Oh, they liked them. Everybody liked vegetables there. They liked eating that. I remember, though, being, before I went stateside, when I was about 5 or 6, 7 years old, we would go out and dig around for something we called mushu, but I hear it's really called musu. And we called the Eskimo potato, but then reading about the Athabascans, they do have a potato too, and it's called a Indian potato. And we would gather a bucket full, and my mother would say, "These don't snap like the ones in the Arctic, because you pick those and they're so juicy they snap, you know, like carrots. But these are kind of tough." But we ate them anyway. We ate them raw and cooked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we picked a few berries around there. A Beaver is not noted for berries. We got our berries from downriver, Rampart, blueberries.
Mm-hmm. But your father essentially was a trader.
Yes, he had a lot of canned foods, you know, canned fruits and canned vegetables and, flour and sugar and salt.
So was that primarily to provision people who were living in Beaver and would come in from the regions, or was it more seasonal for the mining camp?
It was for everybody. It was for everybody. But he bought big outfits because the mining people and the trappers also bought all their outfit. They would be called outfits for that year. The trappers would, most of them would travel by boat, because they could carry a lot more in a boat. Their dogs and pots and pans, stoves, everything would go in a boat with another boat that they would hitch on somehow and take a big load for the whole winter,
mm-hmm.
you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then the miners would get theirs up to the Chandelier by dog team or by... certain times a year, they could use horses.
Did your father then trade for furs?
Yes.
So you were very active as really a commercial center in every aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Where was the closest competition?
Fort Yukon. Fort Yukon had several stores. One of the men decided he wanted to come down to Beaver to build a store. Was from Fort Yukon. One of the first ones that came to build a store close to my dad's was Paul Schultz from Stevens Village. And I couldn't believe it, because I'd come back from stateside with a different idea of things. And I said, how can you help him build a store? And we have a store right here, and you're helping Paul to build his store. But maybe it was for protection, whatever, you know. But there was really not that, it was not competitive that we could see. Mm-hmm. I think Paul had a smaller store. It was mainly for people in that area, maybe. Mm. I'm not too sure. But the other one that came down from Fort Yukon was a bummer, because I remember when Harold Gillum came and needed gas, and my dad didn't have any more left, because most of the pilots bought their aviation gasoline from my father. And then when they went over to Fred's store, I don't remember how much the price went up. It was just something that you couldn't, you could hardly, you could either laugh or cry about, you know. It was just.
And who was Fred?
Well, right now I don't think he has any relatives. His name was Fred DeMar. Hmm. He had a store in Circle, and then he came down to Beaver. Mm-hmm. He floated his store, timber, or the logs.
Logs. Mm-hmm.
And then rebuilt the same building.
Uh-huh. Were they all able to pretty much survive and be in business simultaneously?
I don't know. Nobody seemed to suffer in those years, because we shared a lot. People shared, but I think maybe one didn't share as much, but the others shared. They shared meat and fish, mm-hmm. even wood. My father was at a disadvantage, because the Athabascans, I think, were already into this culture that we're in, that you sell or trade or sell, you know. But the Eskimo culture was to give if you had it. So if we had a wood pile there, an old owler would come by, needed wood, or take a couple, you know, blocks and just take it. It was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. They took care of several children whose parents would have to go out the trap line, and they were missing a year's school. And so Dad would take in two or three a year so they can go to school.
So would they live with you then for that duration?
They would live at our home. I would not be home then, see. I was stateside, and then when I came back, I was home just a week. Then I went to Fairbanks, and during the summer months, when they could go, when the people are back to their own home, you know, having a home in the trap line and having a home where they lived is different, even though one family had two girls that lived 18 miles above Beaver. The girls were still living at what I call my home, which didn't seem to me my home, because they were more at home than I was, because they lived there all winter going mm-hmm. to school, and they knew what to do, you know, how to do and everything, and I didn't know anything. I really didn't know much of anything. It took a while to learn, because yeah, I'm jumping around again, but my mother would be talking to my father, and I would say to my father, "What's Mom saying?" And he would say, "Oh, nothing, nothing." And I would be after him every now and then. He said one time, he said, "Well, you took our daughter away from me for a long time, and what has she learned?" So see, living in a different culture in Washington is so different from going back to Beaver, that the person wouldn't understand what to do sometimes, I think. But it just seems when I went to Tacoma, Washington, it didn't bother me a bit. It just seemed I knew what to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because I was older. I was 8 years old. Had never gone to school, but still knew enough because I had friends of the white people and the Kwajins and the Eskimos and my father, Japanese, you know, that a person can learn quite a bit of things that they don't even know they've learned. This is all I can, you know, I don't know what ever helped me to get along so well out there mm-hmm. in Washington.
Now, the reason that you left was to go to school?
Oh, yes, there were no schools there. I did go a short time at the mission in Fort Yukon, but my mother wanted me to stay home, so they had everybody had partners, you know, like, I think it was for, you know, like, protection or whatever. I don't know how you would translate this, but then people would, like Mr. Mello had a mine in Chandelier, and my dad had a store, and so he got equipment for him, for Mr. Mello to work. You know, was able to, and Mr. Mello could hardly read or write either. In those years, many people, the white people, did not know how to read or write, and of course the Eskimos didn't either, and the Christians didn't either. So there was this great thing about Dad being able to help, and where he learned how to do, I don't know. But he knew how to fill out forms and help people write their orders to Sears mm-hmm. or family matters, you know. So, and what was it that you asked me?
About your schooling and the time that I guess you must have spent at the boarding school in Fort Yukon?
Oh, yes. It was boarding school at the Episcopal boarding school.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't like it, or was it more?
I liked it. But my mother didn't want me to go back up there.
So how long were you there?
I was just there, I think, about 4 months.
And you must have been about 7 or so?
I don't remember about that, I think. Mm-hmm. Because it seems shortly after I went stateside.
That's interesting that she didn't want you to go to Fort Yukon, but she allowed you to go to Washington?
Yes, because, I was talking about partners, you know. Mr. Mello married a girl, a woman, that my father and mother raised. And she had no home in Beaver. I mean, these are like, a family type thing, you know, that when something like this happens, you kind of, you know, see that everything goes right, or you see. And so this man, I forgot to tell you, this man also was from Portugal. Mr. Mello. He was very fair, and he could speak a Spanish type language. Mm-hmm. I remember that. But he had a mine up in the Chandelier, and he married the girl that my mother and father more or less rescued because she was a girl. The family in Barrow could not take care of these children, and the boys were taken right away, and the girl had no home, and she was going from one house to another house getting food, you know, and she was, I think, maybe 9 or 10 years old. And so they took her in.
But she, that was occurring in Barrow.
That happened in Barrow.
How did she get to Beaver?
I think that, I don't know where she and Mr. Mellow got married. But they did get married. And so he wanted his children. They had about four children. And one of the boys, or two of the boys, went to the mission also, but he decided to have it, to buy a home outside of Tacoma and send the children to school there.
Oh.
And so Mrs. Mellow and the older, and the children went out there. And then I went out, see.
So you had a continuation of
yeah.
that partnership
uh-huh.
going there.
Yeah, it's like that little partnership.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we take a break right here, and if you need to. Hannah, we were just talking about the period when you were going off to school. Can you discuss a little bit more about why you went to Tacoma and what the situation was there for your schooling?
Well, Mr. Mello, who had married the girl that my dad and mother raised, had a home in Tacoma, just 4 miles out of Tacoma, in a place called Fife, and his children were going to school there, and so I was sent out to go to school there.
Did you enjoy that experience of being out in Washington?
Yes, it was really great. I had a lot of fun there in the school. The teachers, because we were people from a different planet almost, that they just made so much over us, you know. They had never had Eskimo children there, you know. It was mostly Scandinavian people there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Norwegians and, quite a few Italians too, because they had a big Italian garden there. It was called Colonial Gardens, and they had many homes for the people who lived in this around this garden that they grew. It was like a cooperative type.
Mm-hmm.
Then there were several Japanese people that lived out there, but they rented land from big landholders
mm-hmm.
and worked them.
Did you have much interaction with them?
Oh, we were, many of us were in the basketball games, team together and in track and softball and baseball.
So how old were you when you first went there to school, and how old were you when you returned for more permanent stay?
I went out when I was 8 years old, but I was going to be 9 in November. And so I was one of the older ones in the classroom. I was in the first grade. My first grade teacher's name was Miss Donkey. And I just can remember, she said, "This is not the way to spell your name." And so she changed my name to Hannah. And I was Hannah until I got out of high school. And I'm sure that her name was not D-O-N-K-E-Y. I'm sure it was like D-O-N-Q, whatever, you know. But she was all right, except she made me feel strange that I didn't know how to spell my name. But I had nobody to help me to tell her that this was the right way, and I had no paper to show her. My parents did not come out with me when I entered school.
But even when you spell it its proper way, it gets pronounced as Hannah, doesn't it?
Yes, I was
yeah.
Hannah for a long time.
Uh-huh.
I'm Hannah in Palmer, I'm Hannah in Valdez, I'm Hannah in Bethel, and Hannah just about everywhere else except Palmer. And with my Japanese friends, I'm Hannah. And with the professional people, like when they say in the waiting room, when I'm waiting in the doctor's lounge or whatever, and they say Hannah, and I go by her and I say, "My name is Hannah." Hana. And so I've got everybody trained. It was because I had a dear friend here who found out that my name was really Hana when we were teaching together in Glen Ellen. And he said, "We're expecting a girl, and I want you to say that your name is Hana, because I'm going to name her Hana Marie." And this is what happened, you know. Uh-huh. And so that's why I want to keep that going, even though sometimes people call his daughter Hannah. Now, this good friend was with the Boys...
Boy Scouts?
No. Boys, what is that? It's government type, government, uh-huh. Teaching government to the boys. Boy State.
Oh.
Yeah. And he started that, he started the first Boy State in Glen Ellen. And so when it got around to the state of Alaska, then it sort of cooled down in Palmer. He was asked to go back into it, and he did. And on his way